Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See
terms and conditions. 18 plus. You got that old family house out in the country that you've had for generations and generations that you feel like you'd never leave. Well, of course, you want that protected to the nines. And so that's why this week's sponsor for the Bloom Files is our friends over at Geico. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. And I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com. Truth is out there, and here, who knows? But either way, we are opening up the Bloom Files here on Post Show Recaps, an X-Files First Watch / Rewatch podcast. Hello, everybody. Mike Bloom here, ready to break down two enigmatic essential episodes of the X-Files Season 4 Episode 2, Home, Season 4 Episode 5, The Field Where I Died. Of course, I am not alone. I am joined by my partner in all past lives, present lives, and future lives, Angela Bloom. Angela, how are you?
Hey, I'm here. I'm ready.
You ready to go? Are your past lives ready to go? Are you experiencing deja vu right now?
I have so many past lives, and they're ready.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to, bury the lead too much, or bury the child.
Oh, God.
Because we'll get into that with the second episode. But I know that you and I have had conversations offline, even before watching these episodes, about, the concept of past lives, right?
And I don't think you have any. I think you're brand new.
So I think I'm a brand new little... So it's like that movie Soul.
Yeah. Right?
Like, I'm the brand new little soul that just popped into his first body.
Yeah. This is your first body.
And you're just like the
wizened... I'm like haggard.
The grizzled veteran at this point.
Exactly.
You don't know what you're about to go through, kid.
Exactly.
I've seen some shit.
Exactly.
So we're going to get into two...
And we're going to see some shit.
I mean, we're going to see some shit. These were two... At least one of them was horrifying... And the other one was incredibly emotional and spiritual. Again, furthers this point that I've been making the entire time on the podcast of, I did not think this is what the X-Files would be.
Yeah, you didn't think it would be about the American dream, motherhood, and infanticide?
Exactly. Or this idea of, meeting someone who may be your soulmate.
Yes, and cults. Exactly. And cults, yeah.
So it's just really a nice little mishmash, a potpourri of hot button issues. I mean, let's get into it. We have to start with Home.
Yes.
Because we talked
about... that's the first one we watched.
Of course. But we also talked about this last week, that when we presented the idea of this project, I know that this is one that people said, oh, is he going to watch this one? He's got to watch
right.
this one.
So this is one of the only, or I think the only X-Files episode to have a graphic content warning.
I think it got a TVMA rating.
Right. But when it aired at the time, it had a graphic content warning. It was pretty graphic.
I mean, yeah, this is, it's tough. I don't want to necessarily say scary. Scary is a weird term.
It's like,
right?
It's creepy scary.
It's dark.
It's very dark. It's very dark.
The most grim episode we have seen of the show.
Yeah.
So
and
far.
I like, as soon as in my mind, I remember Home being about the weird peacock family, mm-hmm. the creepos.
Of course, the founders of the peacock streaming system.
Of course.
They went on to great success.
LOL. But I forgot that a lot of this had to do with dead babies.
Yeah, and that's how we open it up. And yeah, it has to be one of the darkest scenes I've seen in quite some time. That's the thing as well, is I know that some people might feel like, oh yeah, this was really big at the time, but I feel like nowadays it's par for the course. That may be, but I think it's still
effective.
Holds up.
Yeah.
And it's weird to say it holds up, but you know, Ryan Murphy, for instance, really likes to produce schlocky, horror, mm-hmm. creepy stuff. But this is legitimately grim.
Disturbing, yeah.
It's so, incredibly disturbing.
And in the beginning, you don't know what's happening. Like, you don't know that this baby is, like, so deformed that wasn't going to survive.
It was a dark and stormy night as we open, as it looks like, I don't know, it almost looks like a perverted Frankenstein.
Yes.
Like, someone's on a metal
And the
bed.
Coloring is, like, very gloomy.
Yeah, we did actually have to, turn off all the lights in our room because this episode is shaded so dark. They really
we couldn't see anything.
I mean, I guess because the Peacock home, right, has no
it has no windows. Yeah,
so
and the windows are all like boarded up and everything, so there was really hard to see anything. So halfway through the episode, you were like, "I have no idea what's going on." Yeah. I was like, "Let's turn off the light."
Every time we cut into the Peacock home, because like, I want to see the freaks. Show me the freaks.
Yeah, and you do see them, so it's not like they were not showing them. It's like we just couldn't see them because of our television.
Here comes a baby. I will say, again, that's due to the lighting effects. We're going to find out that's from Mrs. Peacock. I thought it was from a man.
Initially. Yeah, well, I mean, the silhouette they're showing of Mrs. Peacock, it's not like she looked rather, I don't want to say womanly, but it didn't look like a mother giving birth. It looked like some sort of creature.
Yeah, so I was like, oh, okay, we're going into weird Arnold Schwarzenegger Jr. territory.
No, not that.
Which might have been the reason why they go immediately out to the field. They dig a hole. And they bury the baby.
While it's crying.
Yeah, that's... And apparently some behind-the-scenes stuff is like... Apparently this scene was initially much worse.
Yeah.
Like, they included sounds of the baby's cries getting slowly muffled by mm-hmm. the dirt. And the censors were like, no.
Yeah. They were like, no. So you do hear the cry stop before they put the baby in the ground.
Right, to be like, oh, no, but the baby's sick. And so they buried it afterwards, as opposed to we buried this child alive.
Yeah. But, I mean, later on you'll see that they did that because it was so messed up and would not have survived anyway.
Yeah, I mean, this scene is so messed up, much like this child. It's just it's a raw, gruesome way to start, especially from my perspective.
And how did you feel about the Peacock brothers? Did you feel taken out of it at all by their prosthetics?
I guess it was fortunate that I didn't see most of their prosthetics most of the time, right? Like, all we see in this opening one is I noticed there was the bald one. I guess that's Edmund, right?
That is Edmund. That's the daddy brother.
The one who's, and he's just like, he's sobbing about it. But I don't think we see the other ones until the next scene. So what, there's Edmund, the bald-headed one. There sort of is like the one with the long, stringy hair.
Yeah. I know Edmund, the bald one, and then the other two like caveman-looking ones.
Yeah, they look very much like Cro-Magnon. Or if they had been on Survivor near a nuclear plant explosion, right? Where they're both feral... But also,
and they have like
mutated.
Tumors everywhere, and it's gross.
Yeah. So then we cut to the Sandlot 3 in home Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it is jarring. All of a sudden, it's like these kids playing baseball in a field. So you're like confused about what's happening.
I do like, because you always wonder, okay, what's the meaning of the title? They went a little bit spacey, not in terms of the astronomical circumstances.
Well, I think you knew right away that it was about home Pennsylvania.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
The previous week, it was like, oh, Herrenvolk refers to the master mm-hmm. race. This is more so, you are in home Pennsylvania. There's a home plate. And they're talking about the Peacock home.
Yeah, I think it's about home Pennsylvania and then the idea of home. Like, where is your home? What does your home mean to you? How do you encapsulate that into your family and all of that? Especially with the sheriff.
They're just covering all their bases, if you will. Both first, second,
pun
and third.
Pun intended.
Yeah, so, but this is when we also get, you know, a little bit of a call to... Despite the freakiness of this, now we go to a bit of the Americana, and to your mm-hmm. point, that's sort of the point of the episode of, oh no, that's the old Peacock residence.
Yeah, and so the kids are playing baseball, a ball goes into the Peacock household.
The baby Ruth baseball gets hit into the Peacock haunted house.
Yeah, and they just kind of leave it and continue to play. But one of the kids is stepping on one of the one of the bases, and all of a sudden blood starts coming up, and he screams, and then we cut to...
And there's a little baby hand.
There's a little baby hand. Well, I will say the little baby hand did not look like a little baby hand. It looked like a king cake baby hand.
Yeah, well, listen, maybe... I mean, this was just...
It was prosthetic. Like, that didn't jar me because it was so obviously
fake. More
like
a baby-born baby.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but it's still... It's
it was upsetting.
Disturbing, all right? Look, I love you, so I will forgive you for having you show me an episode where there is indeed stuff, bad stuff that happens to children, because that
makes
me really sad.
I know. I try to avoid those, but this we couldn't avoid this episode.
Yeah, I mean, our son is a couple years old, but like we're not too far removed from experiencing him as a little baby.
Little baby Ashy.
Yeah, and so I don't want to equate that image in my mind. Maybe
well, don't, because it's not the peak. We're not brother, sister, mother, father, children.
We're not?
No.
Oh, no.
Sorry, no incest baby hair.
Oh, darn it.
Totally different genomes.
Exactly. So, Mulder and Scully are going to be on the case. This is when we get a little bit of the hint of, oh, yeah, Mulder's a baseball guy,
oh,
right?
Oh, God, yeah.
He's sniffing the baseball. He's pretending to throw a fastball.
Odeball.
Is that what he says? Yeah.
Yeah, he says, like, odeball or something like that.
Yeah, and Mulder is so fixated on this baseball that Scully is just, like,
doing, like, tricks with it, yeah, popping it.
And she's doing the thing right where he pops it on his elbow
yes.
and catches it. and Scully's like,
he's a sports guy.
Mulder, you there? Mulder. Oh, no, here comes an alien, Mulder. Are you going to pay attention? I'm a spokesperson for the ab roller now, Mulder.
I do this a lot to you.
You do.
Yeah, because you get absorbed sometimes.
I have a tough time multitasking.
Yeah, so sometimes I'll trying to ask you something you don't answer, so I'll just start saying stuff to try to get your attention.
But Mulder's not necessarily immersed in just the baseball, right? Because the baseball means something to him. He's, you know, back in the days when things were simpler,
yes.
where we'd eat bologna sandwiches and I had no cell phone on
me.
He
has some daddy issues.
He's a real Gen Xer at this point.
And he has some daddy issues. You know, maybe playing catch with dad, it brings back some memories and
like
all that.
Kids have much better these days.
No, I think he feels like
they can't afford their peacock homes because they're avocado toast.
That's what he would say now.
That's true, exactly. No, in this case, he sort of is becoming more of a boomer, right?
Yeah, he's more of a... I think for him, he wants it to be simple.
Well, yeah, because his life is anything but.
Yes.
So we find out a bit of a background on the Peacock home. First off, the town of home is only a few hundred people. It's very much like almost under the dome, like in that they
it's
pretty
just
much
a rural area. Pennsylvania. I mean, we went to college in Pennsylvania, but there are extremely rural towns there. I mean, there are just these pockets of literally like three farmhouses. I mean,
even the college that we went to, I mean, they nicknamed it the Mullen Bubble because it very much had that similar, like, insular type of feeling where everything's contained within a certain, you know, square radius and nobody really leaves there and it fosters its own community.
Yeah, and so home Pennsylvania is like that, where it's very much so Pleasantville and nothing happens, nobody locks their doors, the sheriff doesn't even carry a gun.
Yeah, but, I mean, Mulder will soon find out that that's not the case maybe later on, because they have this dark secret in the form of the Peacock Farm, which is home to three, quote-unquote, human men, I think is the way that they put it. And there's a story about, the parents got in a car wreck, and the bodies got dragged back to the house, so we don't know if they're alive, but we know that they've been living on this farm since the Civil War, completely self-sufficient, off the grid, basically.
They said they grow their own food. Mm-hmm.
They tend to their own livestock.
They have their own pigs, and they grow their own lives. Or they, what do they say? Basically, he was like insinuating incest.
Yeah, basically, like they're planting their own family tree.
And then he was like, "If you get my meaning," and Mulder's like, "I do."
This cop is intriguing the sheriff. Like he really likes to monologue.
He goes so aggro during, I don't want to say aggro, but like ham, I don't know, just like really aggressive about how amazing his hometown is, and like, he doesn't want anything to change.
These damn hicks are effing everything up. I don't want anything to change right now. We all have peaceful, simple lives, so you complicated government folk better not come in and interfere with our day-to-day.
Exactly. But they're gonna.
I mean, it's so simple to the point where at the police station, they don't have a morgue.
They also don't have he doesn't want to let them in their office, in the office where he sits that has a door, because he never locks his door, and he never closes it, so people would be suspicious if they were in his office with the door shut. So he puts Scully in a tiny, tiny
like
little bathroom.
Like an airplane bathroom, and she's medical doctor.
It had like a half toilet.
Yeah.
The toilet was so weird looking.
This is like if you're trying to buy real estate on the Upper East Side.
Yes,
and
exactly.
That, this is sort of like, it's a studio apartment,
with
basically.
Like a fold-away bed.
Not only that, but so that's where Scully has to do sort of an autopsy on this poor little dead newborn, but it was kept in the fridge.
Yeah.
Like, there's not even a separate fridge for evidence or forensic stuff. It
dead
was more so, hey,
fridge.
Let's keep it next to Carl's leftover liverwurst sandwich.
Yeah, it's really gross. So yeah, they're doing the autopsy and Scully is like shocked. She is like aghast. She's just, first of all, totally grossed out.
Mm-hmm.
And then second of all, says like it shouldn't even be possible what she's seeing.
Yeah, she's saying that there's genetic deformities that go back, what, like generations?
Generations, like multiple generations. And also, they shouldn't be able to coexist, all these different deformities.
Yeah, I know that Spencer pointed out something about how it really seems to underline, like, listen, I know, and this is a spoiler alert for what's to come in the series, I know that at one point Scully will be pregnant.
Yes.
And I feel like this scene in particular really underlines this stuff, right? Like her
this episode in general.
Yeah, her reacting to the baby.
So this episode is, I think, the start of this...
Something new?
No. Of this through line of Scully wants to be a mom. And mm-hmm. Mulder sort of puts that on her, but you'll see in future episodes that it's something that she never considered about herself, but that she does want. And you can tell there's a scene later where they're sitting on the bench talking about it.
Yeah.
And Scott Mulder's like, I never considered you to be a mom, but like you'd be a really good mom.
Yeah, this scene right here where basically Scully's like projecting a little bit, right? She's talking about the unfortunate fate of the baby. And Mulder says, oh, I've never seen you as a mother before.
Yeah. And so this is the beginning of that. And I think that it's something about Scully's character that we're just going to start to delve into, the fact that she wants more out of life than just chasing aliens and being in the FBI, and that's perhaps to have a family. But she also, there's this dichotomy of her as like a, I don't want to say working girl, but like as a career woman.
Right, married to her job.
How do you balance the two? And it's okay to want both. And mm-hmm. even in this episode later on, you're going to see Mrs. Peacock basically state that her only purpose in life is children. And
yeah.
And like,
and so she's like to the point where she basically is living vicariously through them in a manner of speaking of like, well, I'm happy if they're happy.
Yeah, it's like creepy.
Yeah. And well, speaking of creepy, you think that the dark aspects end with the opening? No, because Scully's theory basically at this point is, well, they probably kidnapped a woman and are raping her to produce more children.
Well, because they don't think that they... She says this whole thing, this very like Jurassic Park, like life will like
whatever, life finds a way.
Life finds a way, and basically insinuating that there's three males there, and they're very like caveman-y, and they're gonna figure out a way to procreate.
They're gonna club a woman over the head and drag her back to the cave.
Yeah, so it makes sense. She doesn't realize that the mother is still alive, but
right, because that's they had assumed that they got in the car accident and they had died at some point. Because I can imagine that even Civil War era technology probably would not make someone survive a car accident.
Yeah, they brought them back to the house after a car accident and stitched her up. That's terrifying. She's lucky she's alive, honestly.
Yeah, so
well, not really,
they're going to head to the Peacock home and get a fun little upward angle on a gross head.
We were talking about this. The whole episode, there are up angles of shots, and I think that it's meant to be like the view from like the way Mrs. Peacock sees things.
Oh, that's
because later on it's the same view, but it's her looking at Scully.
Right. Well, because that's how we're gonna focus here. They're gonna explore the home a little bit. I guess boys were away, probably about to be a murderer, and they find some clues. Right. They find out that the footprint in the house.
No, the boys were there. They just didn't realize they were there.
Oh,
I think
no. Well, because I know that it's gonna eventually end with them leaving, and it's a shot of Mrs. Peacock's eyes.
So I don't know. Maybe they don't leave the place. Remember, they don't leave the homestead. So maybe they're outside doing something.
Yeah,
or,
maybe. I don't know. I guess Mulder and Scully were super stealthy then.
Yeah, or just lucky.
Yeah. So, but I mean, they're going to enact a plan very soon, right? We get some like gross close-ups of one of them siphoning gas from a car to fuel up their Cadillac that they take occasionally.
Well, yeah. So that's why I said they were, when Mulder and Scully initially go there, they, I think the Peacocks were there because they overhear Mulder and Scully talking about the sheriff, and that's why they have to go kill the sheriff.
Yeah, so, and they do it. I mean,
because the instance is that they have these heightened senses because they're like so anesthetic,
right,
so they can't feel pain, they can smell like really well and track via that, and they can hear really well. But yeah, so they've never left the property. That's why they have to siphon gas and put it in the Cadillac that they found.
Right. So again, if they can't feel pain, like I'm sure they're fine drinking gasoline, I suppose.
Oh, God.
Maybe that's a nice Sprite for them.
That was disgusting.
Yeah, but they're going to drive away. And as Mulder espouses to Scully, like, It's a seedy motel. Doesn't matter if the door's locked, though, because it's a place where you don't need to worry about being in danger whatsoever.
The music in this was interesting, too, because as they're driving away, it's to, like, do you know what song it was?
So it's called Wonderful, Wonderful by Johnny Mathis. But the fun fact is that Johnny Mathis, the musician behind it, read the screenplay for the episode before, you know, when he was asked to license it, and he's like, hell no.
Yeah.
So they had to have someone record a cover of it.
That's funny. Yeah.
So like, no, I don't want my music in this episode.
Yeah, that's hilarious because it's perfect. It's like basically saying like, this is the best version of life. Like everything's wonderful. Yeah.
It's very much like a Clockwork Orange singing in the rain.
Pleasantville.
Yeah. During that whole home invasion thing. And that's what basically happens here. It's gruesome, but I think it's really well done. Like the only soundtrack to your point to this scene is Wonderful, Wonderful. This is very much out of like When a Stranger Calls or The Hills Have Eyes, like that specific type of horror as well.
This was, I think, even scarier than the end for you because it was like you were basically embodying the way the sheriff was feeling where he's standing by the door and like shushing his wife and like holding the bat and you're like just waiting.
Swing away.
Yeah. And so he does his best to defend himself, but he is bludgeoned to death.
Yeah, he tries because he knows what's coming, right? That's why he does lock his door. And so he tells his wife to get under the bed, and he gets ready, but the bat can only do so much work before these guys just overpower him.
No, he did lock his door.
I thought he did.
No, so they showed the door unlocked.
Oh,
that was the shot. They're sitting on the porch before it all happens, and he's just like, I have a feeling everything's about to change. And she's like, don't be dumb, come to bed. And they walk inside, and they leave the door unlocked.
I mean, everything does change, specifically
their lives. Yeah. Oh, God, so terrible.
Yeah, but and then all we hear in the background is just like, oh, it's wonderful, isn't it wonderful, as this poor couple is murdered.
Yeah.
And so while one cop is dead, the nephew of the cop is now on sort of like a revenge mission.
He was the nephew? Pastor? I think he was just like a...
I thought he said he was his nephew.
Oh, I didn't hear that. But either way, he's like the young buck, the up-and-coming deputy is now the only one left.
Basically, I'm assuming
his name is Pastor, too.
This is such
weird.
A simple town that there probably are only two cops in it, a cartoon.
Yeah. And yeah, none of them carry guns, which is weird. But Pastor pulls out his gun, and he's like, we have these. And
yeah, Mulder says he's a real Chuck Bronson.
Yeah. Of course,
Mulder would specifically nickname Charles Bronson Chuck Bronson.
Yeah, he's special.
Also, Mulder has a really creepy reference early on in true Mulder fashion, whereas they're hanging out at the motel, he's about to leave, and he goes, oh, good night, Mom. And it's just, it's so pervy on so many levels.
But I think this is very typical. I don't know if it was meant to be pervy, but it does come across a little pervy. It's meant to be like a joking sort of like, haha, we were talking about you being a mom. I think this was typical back in the day, you know?
Right, and it's also very much like, what was it, the Waltons, like, goodnight, John Bob, or whatever that
is. Oh, no, and I think it's like, remember, you'd be like, if somebody was like telling you what to do, you'd be like, whatever, Mom. Like, I think like that.
I didn't do that, but I feel like you did in your teenage days.
No, I didn't. But you know, if you were hanging out with your friends and
we're being like, oh, you shouldn't do that. Like, yeah, right, Mom.
Exactly, like that. No,
I'm going to fall down these stairs.
Michael, I would never say that to my mother.
No, but I think, would you say that? Well, I guess, yeah, you were not as impetuous as maybe some of us were.
I was impetuous from like the age of like 1 to 5. And then I became like a little tiny, like meepy, like I was so afraid to get in trouble. Mm-hmm. And
so
then
you got your troublesome phase out of the way, your rebellious phase in your first 5 years.
It was more like verbal rebelliousness. Like I just thought I was like very smart, and I was.
And
I was,
you were
very intelligent.
Listen, you're just speaking the truth. You're
just yelling at Santas in malls and telling them I know what's what.
Exactly. Like you knew the truth.
I did.
That maybe other kids that age didn't.
They didn't.
You're really like a Mulder in that regard, right?
I was. Very
where you're like, the truth is out there, and I know it.
It's going to be Asher.
So we cut to the peacocks here, as they're sort of like, the peacocks are going to have their day tonight.
Yeah, they're like getting ready, and it's like all to a... which is weird that they're getting for something, because I thought they just did something.
Yeah, you think that they did something big, but... Well, I think it's because they basically feel like, okay... Now that we killed the cops, the
they're
feds
gonna
are going to
come,
gonna,
for
are gonna come
us,
here,
yeah.
And so we're going to... It's actually compares very nicely to the second episode we're going to talk about. Like, we're going to defend our home, you know? But they're doing... I mean, the ritual involves what? They're eating bread and puking it back up, it seems?
No, I think he was chewing food and then giving it to his mother as, like, a baby bird.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, that's, like, your worst nightmare. I do that a lot for Asher, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's also a nice reverse of, you know, the baby bird chewing up and giving it to his mother instead of the other way around.
So,
and then they're getting naked.
Yeah, this was always really confusing to me because I think that the bug insinuates that they're gonna like do something. So I always thought they were like getting naked to all like, I don't know, have sex with the mom or something.
God.
But I don't think that's what actually happens. But that's always how I felt, and I was always a little like nervy.
Yeah, I mean, nervy and pervy.
And icky.
They're getting changed, and like you said, I guess it's Edmund, right? Is giving this his own little Braveheart monologue? Right?
No, it's
like,
the mom.
Is it? No,
it's the mom that's giving it.
That's giving the monologue about we have to fight change.
Yeah.
Really?
It's the mom. She's the one that's like, she's...
But we don't see her yet.
No, you don't see her. You only hear her. And none of the three boys talk.
Oh, I thought Edmund talked for whatever reason. No, because he talks at the end.
No, she talks to him. That's her voice.
From the trunk of the car in the end. That's her voice.
He's in the trunk with her. And then he gets out of the trunk.
That's wild.
That's her.
That's wild.
That's her voice.
That's absolutely bananas.
It's the mom.
All right. Well, maybe we'll look this up during the break because
you don't believe me. I know you don't, but it's true.
I want to believe, but I'm not.
Mike loves to do this. He loves to fight me on stuff.
I'm just going to fight you.
But I know it's right.
You're probably right, but it's definitely the mom. Wild to me. Now we have this like disembodied voice that is guiding them as they get ready to fight.
Yeah.
Fight with their muskets.
It's the mom.
Yeah. And so, you know, what's his name? Pastor. He's ready to go in guns blazing. And he quickly dies. They have
because they have a booby trap.
Yeah. They go home alone style.
He's decapitated.
I'm not afraid anymore, you dirty bandits. And so he walks in, like does a tripwire and an axe cuts his head off.
And then the brothers apparently rip him apart.
For no reason, because they're not like cannibalistic, I would imagine.
And, I mean, maybe they are. They probably are.
And this is also where you made a note of this before, but this is when Mulder's going to vocalize how animalistic they've gotten, right? Because he had also been watching a documentary on TV about
something.
Pack predatory models. And so I think he's relaying what he saw on National Geographic. And so they're going to run into some sheep. And this is a very fun moment.
No,
very
piggies.
Is it piggies or?
It's pigs. They release the pigs.
But that I feel like that makes less sense
than... No, it does, because Babe is pig.
Right, but isn't Babe supposed to move the sheep?
Yeah, but it's fine.
Apologies if I'm forgetting details about this, because there are things that very much stick out in my head that maybe some of the smaller details have been obscured.
No, so they decide they're going to release the pigs because that's going to distract the brothers.
Yeah, but so, I do like Scully quoting Babe.
Bah-ram-yo.
Sincerely.
Sincerely.
And Mulder goes, and people call me spooky.
Yeah.
And that should bring up a point here. So this episode comes from, both of the episodes we're watching, interestingly enough, come from two writers, Glenn Morgan, who's the older brother of Darren Morgan, and James Wong. These guys haven't written for the show, I think, since like season one.
They
or
left
two.
The show after season two.
Yeah, and so I feel like it's been a while since we've had the callback to Spooky.
Yeah.
And I feel like they were like, oh, yeah, everybody.
And it's in both episodes.
Yeah, everyone still calls Mulder Spooky, right? Let's bring that thing back.
I like it.
It's just a fun thing of, they haven't called him Spooky for a while. So they get back into the home. They find newspapers that date back to Elvis's death.
Yeah, and she sees Scully notices all the pictures on the wall, too, of, like, the peacocks through the different times, I guess.
Yeah, peacocks through the ages.
Yeah, exactly.
And so they find the woman.
Yeah, so this is a bit of a jump scare, but I think I prepared you well enough that it wasn't a jump scare. It was just a creep scare.
I was not startled. I was more so... alarmed?
Yeah, because the way I remembered it, they pull her out and she just starts screaming.
Yes.
And that does happen, but it wasn't like so much like that it scares you.
No, it's less about the sound to me, and it was more about the sight.
Yes.
Which is a woman with her arms and legs cut off.
Quadruple amputee.
Screaming at the top of her lungs.
Yes.
Jesus Christ.
And then she turns her head and she has that like eye that's bulging out and half of her face is like missing.
Pig snout at the end of it. Bah, ram you.
Well, I think it's just that her nose is like gone.
Right, because they had to do Voldemort. Some last plastic surgery to make her survive here, essentially. But yeah, it's a rough. It's one of the most visually arresting things I've not only seen on the X-Files,
but it's really upsetting.
On TV in quite
Plus,
some time.
You think about the fact that this woman is, you don't know who she is yet. You don't know it's the mom.
Right, you assume that this is the kidnapped woman.
Yeah, so you are very upset.
I mean, it's incredibly upsetting because think about just like the perverted existence that this woman has had, right? Where yes, they had been raising their odd incest family on the farm, but like Now she has to live this miserable life.
But she's not miserable. This is like, it's her duty. She's honored to bring these children into existence. Yeah. Disgusting.
Disgusting. And Mulder's like, Scully, you should try to sympathize with the mother. I know you've got baby on the brain.
So yeah, this was annoying to me. Mulder's like, why don't you go talk to her while I keep lookout?
Yeah, because he basically is trying to say, the only way this is not going to end in a firefight is if you talk to the mother.
Convince her to leave.
To convince her to, like, to tell the boys to back down.
Yeah, and to let us, like, bring her to safety or whatever.
And obviously that doesn't happen. She is clearly down that well at a certain point where she says, you know, I can tell you don't have children. Maybe one day you'll learn.
You'll understand.
The pride when you know your boy will do anything will for his mother. Yeah, exactly.
In her southern accent.
Not exactly a beacon of motherhood.
No.
I should say, I don't know. You're a mother.
I am. Agree or disagree? I disagree. With everything she ever says.
Vehemently. But I mean, she's not going to be a mother of three for very long, because basically, one, they're all going to come to a head. One brother's going to get killed by his own trap. Another one's going to get shot by Mulder in a confrontation. Mm-hmm. But by the time that they try to go back for the mother, she has escaped, but it's very clear that someone has helped her escape just due to her hindrances, I should say.
Yeah, and I guess so. They pull out the bed, and the bed, it's missing. They see the scrapes on the floor. Yeah,
there's like a spider hole, almost.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they were able to get away, and then we end on basically the two of them were hiding out in the trunk, just sort of waiting for the feds to go away, and we have someone, I suppose it's the mother, monologuing about, like, oh, we're going to find a new home and we're going to continue our family.
You have to think about it this way. She is the one that is encouraging all of this, basically.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know anything, these boys. So she's like, it's okay. We're going to make a new home.
Yeah. And so he drives them off to a new home.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah.
Do you think it's sort of that thing from How I Met Your Mother where, like, that's the only tape that's in the tape player?
I think so.
So he's just getting growing crazy listening to that for hours on hours on end. What's interesting to me is that this, much like the tomb stuff from the beginning of the series, really sets up Edmund and his mother will return. Do they ever?
I don't know. No, I mean, they're going to go find... I mean, they don't in the X-Files, but the idea is that they're out there doing this all over again.
Right, but what I mean is, you know,
Do we see them again? No.
Okay, because we got to follow up, obviously, to Eugene Toombs later on this
season. No, but that was, like, very tactical. This is like, no, we don't see them again.
Which is great, because I'm fine watching
Home. Yeah, it's like, it's one and done.
One time, and one time only. We should mention before we take a break here some inspiration for this, right?
It's not the Charlie Chaplin stuff?
Yes, there's a few things. First, there's Brother's Keeper, which is a documentary from 1992, which basically had talked about a similar story to the Peacocks, that there was like this family that had, through generations of incest, lived on this farm, basically, and then I think one brother killed another brother, and so the police got involved. And so it was sort of incorporating that point to the lifestyle, as well as you mentioned, Charlie Chaplin tells a story in his autobiography where basically he had stayed in like a miner's home while he was on tour, and his host had introduced him to this legless man named Gilbert who slept in a kitchen cupboard.
Yeah, legless guy.
Yeah, and I think Glenn Morgan misremembers that and makes it like, oh no, it was a man with no arms and no legs.
I mean, it doesn't really matter because it's really weird and creepy.
Yeah, and so it's a very arresting image, and so they really wanted to invoke
that.
Yeah,
obviously stuck with him, you know, which is like a little crazy.
Yeah, and it's gonna stick away with all of us, especially this ending sequence as well. Like, mm-hmm. This idea of globalization has taken over, and so now he's going to drive away in his white Cadillac.
And start a family somewhere else.
Yeah, to start another.
Which is also upsetting because that means that she's going to have to get pregnant with his baby again. It's yeah, like,
exactly.
Ew.
They're going to find another white picket fence house.
What?
Raise 2.5 mutant children. It's just, it's absolutely sickening. But I do like how, again, it's a perversion on that warped ideal of the American life, right? That, like, despite this insistence of, oh, this town is nice and simple, these guys believe it too, but they're using it in their own way, almost against the entire idea of simple American life.
Yeah, it's like a sort of dystopian version of that.
Exactly. So we're gonna take a break to just like get away from that.
Yeah.
And then when we come back, we're going to talk more Civil War stuff, though. I'm going to get into the field where I died.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
All right, we are back. Now, I don't want to spend any more time specifically in Home, but I want to issue a couple of corrections from the first half before we move into the second. First, you're right. That pastor was not the nephew. I think I misheard when he said deputy instead of nephew.
Yeah, you heard deputy as nephew.
But I think the big question from the first half of this podcast as to whether or not it was the mom or one of the brothers talking, the answer is actually we're both right. According to the transcript, apparently the first speech when they're getting ready is from one of the brothers. It's from Sherman, but the final monologue is from Mrs. Peacock.
Okay, well, they sound the same.
Well, they have a lot in common. I suppose, specifically genetically. Shall we move into the field where I died?
The field where I died.
Yeah, because this is a really interesting storytelling device. Like, this is going to end up coming full circle, but this is media res, where Mulder is reading a poem, right?
Yeah, I don't think this is the last time they'll do this. You've experienced it as well, when they were in the reservation, and Mulder is like, philosophizing about
And we've experienced a bit of media res when it was Scully runs in on Mulder, keep him cold or else he'll die.
Yeah, they love to do also just the voiceover of David Duchovny doing some sort of
They love to put a paragraph of text in front of David Duchovny in the studio and just say, can you read this in your like very nice monotone voice? So I think it works for him. It's a very meaty poem. I was trying to, put on my 12th grade English hat and analyze it.
Yeah, I looked it up and it's not something I was familiar with anyway, but it is very much so about like following your path or something.
Taking the sage's path is really what he's talking about. And Mulder himself has a really interesting look. Like, he looks even different. He's got a little bit of a middle part. His hair almost looks like it has some product in it.
It's a little floppy.
Yeah, but I mean, his...
He's also rocking that rolled up shirt sleeve look that I love so much.
But I think he's distraught. He's just standing in a field looking at Civil War photos. It's a very arresting cold open. And it should also be noted that, I mean, this is going to be a very Mulder-heavy episode. I believe one of the reasons why this show was written was to give David Duchovny a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, to give him a little bit of an acting challenge, test his chops, so to speak.
Well, I think especially with the way that season 3 ended and season 4 began, I think we talked about this last week, that, David Duchovny's like, he's really beginning...
He has depth.
He's beginning to really expand himself. Okay, now let's really, keep his heart rate up in that manner of speaking.
Yeah, and they found that they liked giving him and Scully more depth-driven episodes where we're diving into them as people and not just people related to aliens.
Right.
We finish this poem and then we quickly go back, I guess, to a sort of like... What would you call this?
It's a commune.
Yeah. Like, I was going to say a temple, but it's, a commune. And it's like all the FBI are there, right?
So we are raiding the Temple of the Seven Stars. This is going to be our cult for the episode. I think this is our first episode covered on the podcast around cults.
Definitely our first. There's been like cultish ones, mm-hmm. especially.
Well, you talked about like the vampire cult or the cannibal cult.
Yeah. And then there was one with like a bunch of kids in a school, and there was that kind of cult type thing. Like
kids in a school cult, like a club?
No.
Cult club?
I'm not even going to go into it. But cults are abound in the X-Files. And I also feel like there's this tendency for, especially in the earlier seasons, for Scully to like try to explain paranormal stuff as, oh, it was probably a cult.
Yeah.
Like if there's any sort of like ritualistic sacrifice or something, it was probably a cult. There was one where they were eating people. That was a fun cult.
Yeah, it's like the cannibal cult. I mean, it's the cults were, I guess, I don't want to say the rage back in these days, but they were certainly at top of mind, to the point where I believe that the Heaven's Gate, like that whole UFO religious cult with the poison Kool-Aid, I think that happened about 6 months after this episode aired.
Oh, really? Because yeah. they talk about Waco.
About Waco. So we're sort of like in the midst between like the Manson stuff.
Yeah.
With Oklahoma City as well. Yeah. So like there's
cult central.
The 90s were it was the cult decade.
It was. It truly was.
With
also
cult classics as well.
And then I feel like recently in our time, there's just been a lot of like interest in cults from a like Netflix documentary perspective. So learning about them.
So. Yeah. So, but the X-Files is here doing what, you know, Making a Murderer will do 20 mm-hmm. years later. In their big-ass FBI jackets.
I love them. I also just feel like I like that Scully's wearing, like, clearly a men's FBI jacket. Yeah. Like, they couldn't just get women's sizes.
No,
at the
you
time.
Rock it. I mean, Gillian Anderson, you rock it. You
they
wear
look
it well.
Great. Also, I love the way she runs, like, when she, like, with her gun down.
Yeah. But Mulder is going to get, I don't know, some sort of sign as to...
Yeah, he gets a feeling. He gets, like, a vibe.
I mean, it's deja vu,
I think.
And so he finds a bunker, a la Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Yeah, he looks out through this glass window, and he sees a field, and he walks into the field, and Scully's like, where the F are you going?
Yeah,
she's
up?
Like...
Well, you're walking off into the middle of a
well,
field.
Well, and she also says a few again? Times, there's like, there's no intelligence as anything beyond the yard. Yeah. Where are you going?
But evidently, Mulder's on the case here as he finds an underground bunker.
Yeah,
where
they hear whispering.
It was, what, Ephesius Vernon or Vernon Ephesius, whatever his name is, the cult
yeah.
leader.
Vernon is his first name, I think.
Yeah, and then his, like, six or seven wives.
Ephesian.
Who were all about to poison themselves.
Yes. They're all gonna kill themselves.
And so they stop them to do it, and now they're under lock and key,
mm-hmm.
and they're gonna be interviewed about it. Seems like Vernon, this guy's up to no good.
Well, so they raided this compound because of a tip that they got at the FBI from somebody named Sydney
mm-hmm.
that basically said they had weapons.
They had illegal weapons.
They had illegal weapons, and they were hurting the kids, and there was all this like information that gave them the enough justifiable cause to go raid this compound, but they can't find the weapons.
Yeah, and the Sydney voice sounds a lot like, I don't know, like Brian Doyle Murray.
Mm-hmm.
Just this kind of voice that talks like this.
Yeah, very cigarette smoker. Type of vibe.
Exactly. And so now it's on Mulder and Scully. Essentially, what they have to do is find out, give probable cause to raid the compound to find the illegal weaponry. Like, they just have a tip-off at this point, but they have no evidence that their illegal weapons are being stored on the compound.
Right. And they also don't have anything to really keep these people much longer.
Yeah.
They're going to have to release them soon.
Exactly. So they've been trying to go through the Rolodex of wives. And here we arrive on really the main wife of the episode.
Yes.
Melissa Ephesian. It's always the Melissa.
Always
isn't it?
The Melissa. So this episode was actually written with this actress in mind, apparently.
Yes. Kristen Clokey, which, if you remember, when we were talking about the writers for this episode,
yes.
I do believe she is the wife of one of
oh,
the
Oh, really?
Writers.
I didn't know that. I just knew they wrote it for her because she was in a series of theirs prior.
Yeah, really, Spencer compares it to like Tim Burton and Helena Bonham Carter. Of like,
great.
You know, cast your partner in
love
these
that.
Types of things. Well, I think specifically they're like,
in this, it works in this because she's not like a famous person. I didn't know who she was. It's fine.
But they're like, she can do voices. She can do personalities. Now, look, I think it's a little bit far from, you know, more impressive displays of multiple personalities.
Well,
or like United States of Terra.
Well, so this episode was supposed to be 18 minutes longer and they had to cut.
Wow, an hour long?
They cut three personalities.
Oh, interesting.
So there were
three.
So there were three additional personalities that they had filmed of hers, and they cut it down to three.
Yeah, because Melissa, I mean, look, initially is like very Janine Garofalo, I suppose, if I'm invoking another 90s celebrity.
I guess, yeah, she's supposed to be like your basic sister wife.
Yeah, but you know, when we see her, she's smoking a cigarette. She's a little droll. She's denying an attorney. Only been there for a year. And then all of a sudden, she just transforms and she's closed her eyes.
She has like a little like.
She's like Gilbert Gottfried.
Yeah, she's like almost like winking, I guess, wincing.
Yeah, she's wincing and she's like, I think she's like, she's tapping on her finger.
She's a little tick.
But it's almost like she's holding a cigar.
Yeah.
She really does remind me of Gilbert Gottfried.
Yeah, very much so.
Oh, my husband, Jafar.
Yeah, very much so. And so basically, they're interrogating her and all of a sudden she's changed into this guy. And
but it's interesting because
Mulder like snaps up. He's like,
Well, because it's a debate. The classic Mulder Scully conflict is Scully believes classic multiple personality disorder.
Yeah.
Mulder believes this is her channeling a past life.
Yes.
Because,
and so
Sidney talks about how Harry Truman is the president.
Yeah. So he has some evidence for this, but I think he's really going off his gut feeling because he feels like he obviously believes in past lives. And then on top of that, like had some sort of deja vu where he found her and he seems to recognize her.
Yeah.
Like whenever he sees all three of them, he like his eyes go to her and he's like, like this is weird. And so, yeah, they're sort of fighting about that. And then also a typical classic Scully Mulder. They're saying like, oh, you led her on type vibe.
Well, that's the thing. I think Scully's trying to say, oh, no, you're chasing down this Melissa path for yourself because you feel something in different parts of your body. And Scully also provides some interesting intel that obviously I did not know as a mere child of the 90s, that apparently, according to her, at this point in time, multiple personality disorder is not really regarded as real.
Yeah, so I think that's why, so Scully says it like, I don't know, but it could be this. Like, she's not, like, guaranteed.
Right, she's saying, well, there's this new underground scientific phenomena called schizophrenia.
Well, so, yeah, I think she's saying more like, it's like a new I mean, think about mental health.
Yeah,
like, the amount of stuff that was discovered between the 90s and now is like, I mean, it all existed. There was just no name for it. So she also maybe is saying, oh, multiple personalities, it's so weird, it's out there. And she thought maybe Mulder would think the same thing, but he's like, no, let's go a step further, past lives.
Yeah, and so they're going to explore some more past lives or personality, what have you. Do you think it's past lives? Are they trying to imply it's past lives?
Yeah, they're definitely trying to imply it's past lives, but hypnosis time.
Yeah.
Oh, baby.
Well, first we're going to get, you know, like you said, many personalities got cut. We get a couple here. We get a brief glimpse at Lily, the child.
Yeah, so they go back to the compound with Melissa because they're like, let's bring her there.
Let's do some sense memory things.
Maybe she'll lead us to where the weapons are, especially as Sidney, because they realize Sidney's voice is the informant.
Right, so basically, including the name as well. They knew that Sidney was the one to tip the feds off about him. So
and
clearly,
they couldn't figure out who it was until now.
But Sidney only knows a certain amount of information, so it's like maybe there are these various puzzle pieces of personalities that can get put together to form one cohesive picture. But Lily is going to leave very quickly, which is fine, because again, I don't like adult babies or adults acting like children.
Yeah, and she didn't. I would say her acting as Sidney is amazing. Her acting as Lily is annoying.
Yeah, but I think we get into, I think personally, my favorite personality, which is her southern debutante.
Love it.
Standing out in the, she's right. She's
speaking of Civil War.
She stands out in the middle of the field, yeah, talking about like, oh, the guns are hidden in the bunker. And she basically is narrating a letter from a Civil War nurse to her husband, I suppose, Beau?
Yeah, so basically narrating herself as this Civil War nurse writing to her husband who is in the war.
Who is dead.
Who is dead at the time.
Because she ends with, this is the field where I watched you die.
Yeah. So I think it's more, maybe it's more like a monologue. Like, it's like in the form of a letter.
It's like if we're trying to paint a picture here that
her diary.
Past Melissa had gone to the field and like maybe penned a diary entry.
Yes.
Of like, oh, I went to the field. I went to your grave site today.
Yeah, exactly. It's like her diary.
I'm like, what is his name? Oh, Sullivan. Sullivan Biddle.
Sullivan Biddle.
Sullivan Biddle. I don't
is
know.
Not a real name.
Sounds like the name of an old coot
that
was found in like a mine shaft after 10 years.
Yeah, so there's Sullivan Biddle and Sarah Cavanaugh. These are the other two. And Mulder is convinced that he is Sullivan Biddle.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
He's like, that's me.
He's like, wait, I knew it. There was something here.
Yeah.
There's something here. It's hundreds of years old at this point.
Yeah, so they're going to, is this where they do the hypnosis?
Yeah,
they
so
go back?
Do, well, he wants to do the hypnosis, and Scully, he's of course angry at Scully for not believing the past lives thing. I do think this is when they do the hypnosis
on Mulder.
Yeah. No, well, first on Melissa.
I think they do that before they go to the compound.
Well, Melissa talks about, tells a story, right, about, because there's been accusations of, what was Vernon doing? And I guess one of the stories, because when you hear he did stuff to children,
yeah,
your mind jumps to a bad place.
Yeah. And also, like, what, like, which children are they okay? Do we need to, like,
yeah,
bring in child protective
more
services?
Abuse. It's, they tell a story about how, like, a boy was taken from his mother because Vernon believed he was the reincarnation of a prophet.
So, yeah, this is Melissa telling a story,
yes,
about a woman that she became friends with who showed up on the farm, and they took them into the church, and the son was...
Took them to the church!
Sure. The son was a reincarnation of the prophet, so Ephesian took him under his wing. But then, like...
Slash stole him away from his mother.
Stole him away from his mother. And his mother, like, snuck in to see him one night. And Ephesian took that to mean, like, he's clearly not the prophet. And he beat the shit out of both of them.
Exactly. And called him garbage.
Oh, so mean.
But as Melissa's about to go into more of the story, Sydney comes in, which
yes,
is interesting.
And he's like, leave her alone.
Yeah, he's supposed to be her, like,
protector.
I'm your protector, Jafar.
He doesn't sound like that at all.
No, that's exactly the voice. It's pitch perfect.
Okay.
But after all that, after that, you know, they hit that dead end very quickly. Mulder's like, hey, you know what? I'm here. Why? What the heck?
Let me
try some hypnotherapy.
Yeah. Mulder loves to be hypnotized.
And what I noticed about both of them when they underwent the hypnotherapy, they do this thing where they put their right arm.
Yeah. So I think that's a control. Like, it's like a focus point.
Oh, interesting.
As far as I'm aware. I mean,
because
we can
it's not like giving blood, right? Where you have to, like, keep it elevated.
I think it is a little bit, like, not like that, but, like, kind of like touching, like a touch point, maybe. So, like, if your arm is up, you're focused on that, and it helps you zone out.
Yeah, maybe it almost looked like he was, like, grabbing onto one of the bars, like he's standing on the subway.
Yeah, but I definitely think it has to do with, like, getting into the zone.
Well, Mulder is in the zone, and it is a rough zone. We go through one of Mulder's supposed past lives,
yes,
where he is a mother... A Polish mother during the Holocaust.
Yeah, this was a little wild to me. I felt like they were just pulling, like, from such, like, specific historical things, you know, Civil War, Holocaust. Like, if you think about your past life, most likely it was just, like, some rando.
Yeah, well, and
what are the chances that your past life is somebody who went through such a traumatic, like, existential situation?
What I find so interesting about this is not only the idea of past lives, but also that no matter what iteration you exist in, your lives are always connected. It's very much like...
This is pretty common, though.
Vandal Savage and the Hawks.
Yes.
Where, because Mulder says, like, oh, my sister Samantha was there, but this time Samantha is her son. He talks about his father
and
his mother being there. Scully's there. And the cigarette-smoking man is a Nazi.
So when I talked to... When we watched this, I told you that this is a common theory of past lives, that you travel in the same circle of souls.
Interesting.
So, like... From past life, maybe that's why I'm so haggard. I was just waiting for you.
You're waiting for, like, come on, you're taking forever.
Yeah, exactly. So I was so lonely, and then I found my soulmate.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that that's a pretty common, like, theory of past lives, is that you travel in the same circle of souls as you, like, move through the levels until you hit sort of, I don't know, nirvana or whatever.
Yeah, and David Duchovny really brings it home here, not in home,
yes,
but, you know, it really is just an entire close-up on his face the entire time, and he is really giving it. You know, he like, just collapses into tears, talking about what happened. He mentions that Melissa was his husband, saying we're always taken away every time. This is when we get the Sarah Cavanaugh and Sullivan Biddle, epiphany as well. But, I mean, this is the firsthand evidence that this episode was written to help give David Duchovny a bit of a showcase. And I think he rises to the occasion.
He does a great job.
The entire episode is a little OTT in terms of the emotion.
Yes,
but I guess
it is a little over the top.
But I guess given the circumstances, right, these people are talking about the Civil War, they're talking about the Holocaust, like, these are very emotionally intense situations.
I also wonder if we had watched this one first, would you have felt more emotion? Because you were probably, like, a little, like, not that we watched them, like, sick. Like,
no,
right,
we watched them a day apart.
A day apart, but, like, it's hard to get into this when you're also taking notes.
Yeah.
When you're not just watching. Like, I feel like if you were watching it, you might have been a little bit more invested. But I remember really liking this episode, but never really feeling the, like, same emotional pull that I felt from some other ones.
Yeah, but, I mean, it turns out that as much as Mulder has now gone down a very interesting path, Scully has been... given the unfortunate task of saying, please go to these Civil War battle plans and figure out the bunker in which the weapons might have been hidden. And she looks up a little bit of what, like a guess book?
It's a registry. This is pretty common in like town historical societies. They have registries. They have census information, and they also have like diaries and all that and photos.
And it turns out that
those people existed.
Sarah Tavanaugh and Sullivan Biddle are indeed names. And so maybe it could be, you know, a psychic thing of like, well, I just saw the name and came up with it. But it lends more credence to the theory that these are indeed the reincarnated souls of these two, torn apart lovers from the Civil War era.
Yeah, for sure. I think that it's pretty cool, actually. When I was younger, I used to be super into history, and I volunteered at the Historical Society in my town. And the house that my parents own is actually a 300-plus-year-old home, formerly owned by Aaron Burr. And there were like all these diaries of the people that used to live there, and we have them, and it's pretty cool to read them.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it's like hilarious because it'd be like, today we took down a tree and that'll be it.
So do you think that you and your family are reincarnated spirits of Aaron Burr? Are you Aaron Burr reincarnated?
No, we have to.
Quick, wrap something for me.
We're not related to the people that used to live there 300 years ago.
Maybe it brought you back to that place, you know? Maybe the souls had existed there the entire time.
Anyway.
Just like it did here. So Mulder is going to, he's clearly very thrown to the point where he actually calls Scully Dana for the first time maybe ever in my memory from what we've watched so far. And so Mulder is going to go find Melissa, and Melissa, it seems like she denies it a little bit, right? She rips up the photos that Scully comes back with.
Well, so I think the issue is that she is probably a little stressed out from all of these personalities inhabiting her body.
Right.
So I don't think...
Especially when they want something. The feds want something from her, right?
And I think for her, like, her main motivation is that she was part of this cult, and she's probably grappling with that as well, is this being married to Ephesian thing, and does she remain loyal to him? Does she help the feds? Like, she's probably just like, go away. You know? That's
exactly
what I would.
Well, I mean, I just feel bad. I mean, listen, you mentioned your experience with historical photos. Mm-hmm. She just straight up rips them up.
Yeah, I was a little upset by that, but she doesn't care.
No, well, yeah, it's quite obvious that she doesn't care. She also says, I want to believe, which is very interesting.
Yeah, I liked
that.
Like,
unprompted. Oh, it's very clear that she and Mulder run in the same circles.
Mm-hmm.
So the feds, with no evidence behind them, have to leave the compound, and that makes Vernon decide, like, all right, well, let's go while the getting is good and do our mass suicide take two.
Yeah, so he takes everybody to the temple, to the main temple area.
There's like a big-ass barn.
The meeting house or whatever. And the feds are watching. They can't go until they have probable cause.
And they do when they say, all right, take out those guns and start shooting people.
Yeah, wild. So all of the parishioners, I guess,
cultists
start shooting at the feds, and then they start shooting back, and then Mulder just like runs into the gunfire, and she's like, you're gonna get killed.
Yeah, but I think Mulder feels like he has this spiritual connection to this place, so he's like, no, I trust that, you know, if Melissa is involved, she won't let me die. But Melissa's got her own problems here.
Yeah, so Melissa is part of this whole mass suicide. They're passing out the Kool-Aid. She takes the Kool-Aid, but basically fakes dying.
She fakes dying until they get in there, and then like Ephesian found out about it and basically forces her to drink it.
Yeah, and then does force her, but she kind of just like succumbs to it.
Yeah,
could it be a matter
at that point? I mean, listen, talking about mental health, could it just be a matter of her feeling like it's too much?
I think she just gives up. She's like, I fought, I tried, whatever. Bye.
But as a last message, because again, the last conversation that Melissa and Mulder had was her like turning him away, right, saying, no, this, please go away. I'm not going to help you here.
Yeah.
Ripping up the photo, as Mulder finds Melissa with this like haunting Gregorian monk chanting.
Yeah,
over it.
That was creepy.
She was holding on to the photo.
Yeah, because I think that she was having a tough time.
Yeah, and so she was. It meant that he clearly still meant something to her, even though she turned him away.
Yeah, or that the whole situation meant something to him.
So it ends, as we talked about how it begins, we cut now to Mulder standing in the field with those two photos, sort of ruminating on what he just experienced and how this one soul that he has been seemingly connected with has, you know, shed off this mortal coil, moving on to the next body.
Moving on up.
Yeah, moving in some direction at least.
Levels of reincarnation.
Does this come back? Is there a thing of her being like, no, Mulder, I knew you, I was Melissa?
No.
Yeah, I would imagine not.
These sort of Monster of the Week episodes, while they do have, like, very cool ideas and concepts that often tie into the agents, they're usually not brought up again.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, with for example of this is like, oh, a past life. If it's not tied to the main arc, it usually doesn't come back.
Right.
Up
if the past life, we got a mention of the cigarette smoking man here, but really outside of that, there hasn't been a mention of a lot of stuff from the main arc. Well, we can do some quick spooks of the week because there are plenty to choose from, specifically in the first episode.
Yeah. I've the mom.
Yeah, Mrs. Peacock. She, I guess, you know, she did not commit murder, unlike Mrs. Peacock in Clue, but...
No, but she's not good. She's not good.
She was very spooky.
Bad representation of mommyhood,
might
too.
Might be one of the spookiest characters we've experienced so far.
Yeah, for sure.
And when I'm in the field where I died, I mean, I feel bad saying Melissa.
No, Ephesian for me. Like, he's a total creep.
Yeah, I guess he is a sociopath and a cult leader.
And he just is creepy as an actor.
Yeah, because I remember when they're interrogating him, right, and all he just responds,
so
it's
weird.
Like, oh, God will come to cleanse us all.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, buddy.
Yeah, so that makes sense for two spooks of the week. But yeah, these are two of, I think,
what'd you think?
The most impactful episodes we have watched so far.
At least intense.
They're very intense. I think it's tough to say that I enjoyed them as much as I appreciated them, if that
makes
sense.
No, I don't think you're supposed to enjoy Home. I think it's one of those ones that's like, it's you need to watch it as somebody who's doing a rewatch of The X-Files, but it's definitely really upsetting and dark. And then this one is something that I know a lot of people don't like it. They feel like it's too emotional, too, like,
I like that,
heavy.
Though. I like bringing in, like, I know we do a lot of weird stuff and a lot of plot-heavy fun stuff, but sometimes it feels good to get
Very simple.
Emotionally grounded, especially for Mulder, who doesn't really have those.
Yeah, where the mystery isn't, is it past lives? It's how are the past lives affecting Mulder rather than the mystery of figuring out what happened, you know?
Yeah.
It's more about, like, what's going to happen with them as individuals.
Yeah, I do feel bad that Scully's kind of sidelined in the field
where I died. She is. She's, I mean, but she's his support.
Yeah, exactly. Well, next week, we're going to keep moving forward.
Oh, boy.
I believe we're going to stay on the Monster of the Week trail.
We are.
So
we are.
So we're gonna,
well, to an extent. I would say that the both of the ones we're going to watch next week are Monster of the Week episodes, but do have some, like, ties to overarching stories.
All right. So we're going to be doing Season 4, Episode 7, Musings of a Cigarette-Smoking Man. I can only imagine what that one's about.
You're going to love it.
And Season 4, Episode 10, Paper Hearts.
Yeah.
It's a Valentine's Day episode.
Oh, it's so not.
Is it not?
It's really, really not.
All I can imagine is like the, you know, like the third grade classroom decorations of Paper Hearts.
Oh, no, no.
Oh, that reaction makes me very excited.
Don't be.
All right. I will temper my excitement there. So we're going to talk about that next week on the Bloom Files. Please follow along. Send us your thoughts if you want to. xfiles@postshowrecaps.com or BloomFiles@PostShowRecaps.com,
yes.
Or tweet us at @MikeBloomType, @AngePelagi, or @PostShowRecaps about your thoughts on all these episodes. We just talked about two very big episodes. I'm sure people have thoughts about Home especially, so
yeah.
Let them be known. And we're going to keep going through Season 4, which has been hella weird so far.
Yeah.
In a fun way, so I'm excited to see how much weirder it gets.
It will.
Okay, good. That's a guarantee from you to me.
Yes,
so we'll
exactly.
be back again next week. Again, Season 4, Episode 7, Musings of a Cigarette-Smoking Man, and Episode 10, Paper Hearts. Until then, case closed.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.